Good afternoon. I call the order the Commerce Committee hearing for February 6, 2019. Representative Stevenson, have you had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, would you like to move approval?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes. Thank you. And I would move that the committee approve the minutes from our February 5th meeting at this time.
Representative Stevenson moves approval of the meeting minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Today we have one bill on the agenda, House File 400, Representative Olson. Welcome. Gets settled.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'll ask Representative Baker to come up and present the bill with me.
Representative Baker, welcome. Well, welcome to the committee. You can go ahead and proceed, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, it's no surprise to any of us that we are in the middle of an opioid addiction crisis. Parents have lost children. Teachers have lost students. Our first responders are being asked to respond to impossible situations. And no other family deserves to go through this, and Minnesotans expect us as legislators to take action, enacting a comprehensive treatment, prevention, and recovery strategies to end this crisis. Minnesotans are pleading with us to take action to protect people. No demographic group is immune from the results of this crisis. It's time for all hands to truly come on deck. We need everyone, not just to come to the table, but be part of investing in an end to this crisis. While families, communities, and the state as a whole have paid significant prices during the opioid crisis, both in dollars and in the tragic loss of life, House File 400 brings more of the actors in this crisis to invest in efforts around prevention, education, treatment, and recovery initiatives.
And Representative Olson, this might be a good time to just take a pause, and if I can move your bill, and then we can get it officially in front of us, and I see there's an amendment as well. So I'll move House File 400 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations, and I will also, if with you're okay, move the A-12 amendment. It's an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. So I've moved the A-12 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is in the shape you desire, Representative Olson.
Thank
to
you.
Your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So to the bill in front of you as amended, it really builds off great bipartisan and bicameral work that was done last session, but sadly did not move forward. And many of these provisions are not new to this bill, but build from what we worked on before and what folks like Representative Baker have been working on for a while. So House File 400 requires a license and registration of opioid manufacturers and wholesale distributors of opioids. The bill requires the Board of Pharmacy to assess manufacturers' registration fees in total amount of $12 million on a prorated basis based on the total number of opioid units. The bill requires the Board of Pharmacy to assess a wholesaler registration fee in the total of $8 million prorated based on the wholesaler's percentage of the total number of opioid units. And for just a little bit of context as to this provision, the current fees for manufacturers, many who have annual profits in the billions, is currently $240. And to put it in further context to the cost of this crisis has had and the investments we've already paid, my county alone has spent $26 million in out-of-home placement costs directly related to the opioid epidemic. This bill does cover generic opioids, as we know that these drugs make up the majority of opioid units sold according to the FDA. These revenues, in addition to any funds received by the state from the settlement of legal proceedings against the opioid manufacturers, are deposited into a stewardship account. The bill forms an advisory council of a variety of stakeholders who will make recommendations on grant and funding options for funds annually appropriated to the DHS commissioner from the stewardship account. The bill further provides detailed appropriations aimed at education, prevention, and treatment, and providing money to county social services to fight this crisis, as well as specific appropriations for tribes and American Indian organizations. The bill places prescriber guidelines on quantities, certain limitations on dispensing, and provider education. Article 2 seeks to increase access to non-pharmacological pain management options and also deals with situations where medications cost less than a copay. This bill also has language for non-opioid directed and requires disposal receptacles at sheriff's offices. And I would also like to make special note that this bill does not limit access to medications for those with chronic pain or in palliative care. In short, this bill acknowledges the significant costs that are needed to fight this crisis, while also knowing everything cannot be addressed in one piece of legislation. What this bill does is take a step forward in bringing solutions to a crisis that without our action will not end. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Baker.
Representative Baker.
Madam
welcome.
Chair and committee, I'll try to be brief. I thought my comments would just be more of a short story, very short, because we want to get to the testifiers and any questions. But this has been around for a while. We've been talking about this amongst our members for the last 3 years, 4 years of this concept and idea. Before we started session last year, a very short session, I had the bill, and we brought in everybody that loved the idea of this bill and hated this idea of the bill. So we brought them together, the manufacturers, the distributors, the doctors, the advocates, the moms and dads that had lost children, everybody that was at the table, and at that time we had Speaker Dowd at the table as well. And we talked about this very openly because I want people to dissect this bill and tell us what it is then that we can do, because we want to find a number here. And Representative Olson's number is $20 million minimum, period. That's the number we say is a very reasonable ask to find some revenue that we need to help supplement and give our current $200+ million a year in our budget to go towards chemical support. So this is a kicker. This is a 10%. This is a little extra that we really need to provide medically assisted treatment programs that are really doing well around the state of Minnesota. Doctors are signing up to help people with this medicine that is literally keeping people sober for much, much longer. A lot of good policy has been working. We want to give credit also to the folks in the field that have recognized this for the last 4, 5, 6 years, and that would be your providers, your dentists, your pharmacies. They have been actually doing some good things ahead of time and didn't have to have a gun held to their head to do it. Others have had to have that. But I want to be clear about this too. This is an idea. This bill is building. It's getting better as it has stops. There's a part in here that Representative Olson and I know we have to work on a little bit with making sure that we recognize some of the places like Morrison County. St. Gabe's Hospital has an enormously popular national award-winning program that is actually spawning new sites around Minnesota that help family doctors give Suboxone and other medically assisted treatments in the proper manner with good support systems, and we need to keep that going. This is really critical. So those are the kind of things we want to continue to work on and build on. But I think the one thing I want to make sure we do is this is not a penalty bill. This is not something that we want to tell these companies their drugs aren't important. They are. We do not want to take any access away from people. But we just need them to help at the table. And we are going to ask providers and pharmacies to also help with this. But most of this will come from distributors, manufacturers, that have by far and wide profited the most. And the last thing I'll leave you with is this. You'll get people that will come here maybe today. I don't know who's all in the testifying list. And they will tell you that we want to help as a manufacturer or distributor. I'm not sure who's going to come. But if they come up with an idea, please ask them, well, what is your idea? If it's not 12.8, maybe it's 18.2, maybe it's something, but they know our number is 20, and tell them to speak into the microphone, because I can't get them to tell me what that is. Maybe you can, but it's just a time when we need to say, well, then what is it? But it's just, we need their help. Courts are there to penalize, and they'll find that out. That's not what our job is. So let's be straight about that, and Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that, and I think you've got some excellent people to come and testify today.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And Representative Olson, would you like to proceed with testifiers at this time? And members, I think we'll start a list of questions, and if testifiers could hang around for after, I think we'll try to do questions after testimony. And with that, Dr. Ann Pilkus, welcome to the committee. Well, thank you. I'm really happy to hear that. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Ann Pilkus. She said it correctly. I'm a physician. I'm an addiction medicine physician, and I have kind of a unique position. I work in the Health Partners Chronic Pain Clinic. So I see patients who have become addicted to their opioid pain medications through prescribing practices. And I see patients who have chronic pain who continue on opioids. And I also do a lot of just systems work at Health Partners. So I'm doing a lot of work with helping primary care doctors get access to that medication management. I do a lot of work in the hospital. I do consults in the hospital, but I'm also doing some systems work in the hospital to help kind of more seamlessly manage our overdoses. And I just want to call out a lot of, and Representative Baker said a lot of what we're doing, but I wanted to call out that Health Partners is actually holding themselves accountable and decreasing their opioid prescribing. We've decreased our opioid prescribing by 5.5 million pills in the last 2 years. We've decreased our new starts for low back pain, which opioids have never been the standard of care for low back pain, by 51% over the last 2 years, I believe. So we are really doing a lot of work in that area. So we are holding ourselves accountable. And I think most health systems, big health systems in the cities, would say the same thing. I also run my own business. I own a private practice in the South Metro. But my private, I wouldn't really call it a private practice because 50% of our patients are Medicaid or PMAPs. And then I also serve as the medication, the overdose prevention medical director at the Steve Remler Hope Network. So even with all of this good work that we do, that the health systems are doing and that Steve Remler is doing and that everybody here is doing, we still see rising overdose rates. We still see rising death rates, and I still see on a daily basis many, many patients who are either using heroin, and they're using heroin because they started with opioid prescriptions, or they are kind of stuck on pain meds and they don't want to be on them anymore. So we help them get off pain meds when they don't want to be on them anymore. I still see patients that are ravaged by the harmful effects of opioids every day. Every day I see at least one person who is stuck, who has started to be stuck. So I want to tell you a little story about one patient that I saw just last week in clinic. He is a Division I soccer player. He got hooked on pain medicines because he kept being pushed by his coaches and his team to play and play and play and play and play. And here's some pills, here's some pills, here's some pills. And so he got hooked. He's 32 years old. He's been to treatment 5 times. He's overdosed twice, non-fatal overdoses twice. And over the last 5 years that I've been working with him, he has maintained on a medication called Suboxone, and he's really turned his life around, right? He has a job. He has a wife. He has a family, right? And these are things that he would have died. Never would have happened. So this man, who is upper middle class, who has a job where he is working and creating revenue and creating a family, that it wouldn't have happened, right? So in 2017, we had 400 overdoses or 401 overdoses in Minnesota. And there are estimates that rate is actually underestimated, because on death certificates, a lot of times it's not called out. The opioid overdose is not called out, so it's about 25% more probably than that. The age of the people dying in Minnesota is young. It's 25 to 34, something like that. And so we're cutting, you know, otherwise healthy lives short. I read a report yesterday from the White House Council on Economic Advisors, and it's estimating the cost per lost life. And with our 400 overdoses in Minnesota, that puts our state around $5 billion for 400 overdoses. And that's because of the lost lives in the prime of their lives, really. I do remember. I'm not very old in terms of my medical. I'm older than I look, but I'm not very old in terms of my medical. My medical experience. So I wasn't around a lot during like the 90s when a lot of this overprescribing of opioids started happening. But I was around for the tail end of it. And I do remember drug reps coming to clinic and trying to sell us opioids and telling us that they weren't as addictive as we see, as they might seem, and doctors are being overly cautious. I remember that. And I just think that with just the astronomical amount of money that we as a state are not just spending but losing, because these lives are so young and they can be very, very productive. I mean, I see people every day that were in prison or on the way to prison or, you know, homeless, who are now graduating college and working and having families, and living lives that they would not live had they not had access to this sort of treatment. So I think the fact is very clear that pharmaceuticals companies, and it's been borne out, that pharmaceutical companies did mislead physicians and consumers into believing that opioids were not as addictive as they really, really are. And we've seen that now. We know that they're addictive. We're asking for a fraction of their profits. We need to hold them accountable, and we need to hold them accountable not just to the people who have lost loved ones, to the people in the state of Minnesota who are paying for this, to the providers who are working every day to kind of clean up this mess, and to the patients who were misled, and to the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, and if you can just stay nearby for questions afterwards, we appreciate your testimony. Officer Charlie Strack. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Officer Charlie Strack from the Little Falls Police Department, the Central Minnesota Violent Offender Task Force. I'm here today just to talk a little bit about what we've seen at the Drug Task Force and what we've seen and when we started seeing it with the Little Falls Police Department. And I was an officer on the road in the early 2000s, and during vehicle stops started seeing pills in other people's names, and then started seeing sales in prescription drugs. And that's when I was able to join a task force there in Central Minnesota when my chief assigned me to it. But it was really eye-opening, and for me, I, for whatever reason, took an interest in it and started knocking on enough doors to see what was going on with our local doctors and medical staff that prescribed. And through it all, I just seen, man, it's turning into an epidemic. Now, I never would have thought in my wildest dreams that it would turn into a heroin epidemic in Little Falls. And really eye-opening, and that didn't happen until about 2008, 2009, after about 6 or 7 years that we were fighting pills, the pill problem. And after knocking on, like I said, a bunch of doors, we tried probably 4 or 5 times to come up with a task force between the doctors and law enforcement and pharmacy to try and stop this or get ahead of it. And each time it failed, probably maybe lack of money, lack of interest. I believe I stepped on a lot of toes to say, you know, we are overprescribing and people are getting hurt by this. and when I went to them, it was that inadvertently doctors were becoming dealers. And that was my main topic was, you know, you're selling to the patients, and then the patients are turning around, making a huge profit selling to the addicts. And, you know, we were finding and buying at the task force pills for $5 from your Vicodin to $10 Percocets, all the way up to $100 a pill for the OxyContin 80 milligrams. And, at that amount, of milligrams, really it is heroin. And it wasn't that long after that that I think we really did start doing a really good job in Little Falls of getting a prescription task force together and really hitting this head on. And at that time, I believe part of that led to the heroin, although a lot cheaper than pills. They started getting it from the metro and bringing it back to our town. And we've had, you know, I was there, a 17-year-old female overdose, and that was my first one, and that was eye-opening. And since then, we've probably had six or seven more, and many more that we were able to save before they had the fatal overdose. But it's an eye-opening thing to walk into an apartment or a residence and see the arm with the needle still stuck in the arm, and the person is there, and we were able to save, and some we weren't. But I'm here to say I hope that is able to move forward, because it is important to us as first responders. And I think deep down a lot of medical personnel are happy that this is happening, because inadvertently, again, it turned medical into dealers, and I don't think that was ever the way to go from the beginning, but it kind of happened. So I just want to say thank you for giving me the time, and I appreciate being here.
Thanks for your testimony, and thanks for your work up in Little Falls. Appreciate
Thank you
it.
Very much.
And if you can stick around if people have questions later.
Okay.
Next on the list, Shelley Elkington. Welcome to the committee. Get settled, and when you're ready, you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shelley Elkington. I am a board member of the Steve Rumler Hope Network. I'm a mom, I'm an advocate, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to testify in support of Representative Olson and Representative Baker's opioid product stewardship bill today. I'm from Montevideo. Anybody know where Montevideo is? About 125 miles west of here. It's an extremely nice, peaceful prairie community with just over 5,000 residents. I think there's a representative here from a district just south of me. So as I was looking at the members, I was really proud to see the rural representation on your committee here today, because that's really important to me being from rural Minnesota. My daughter, Casey Jo, died as a result of her addiction to opioids on August 19th, 2015. She was prescribed many opioids while she was being hospitalized and after complicated surgeries for a condition called Crohn's disease. Her addiction snuck up on her, on all of us, like a thief in the night, and it eventually stole her from us. After many months of worry, fighting, begging, Casey agreed to see a pain and addiction specialist and was due to arrive at a clinic here in the cities on August 20th, 2015, one day. We were one day too late. I will forever be haunted by that one day. What if it would have been easier to know where to go? Where could we have turned? What if we would have had resources that would have been available to us when we asked for them? How many other people in the state, and particularly in rural Minnesota, are desperately trying to find help like we were? A lot, because I get called all the time. People from your districts. How many of them are going to be one day too late? We have had overdoses and deaths in our town. In fact, just 3 weeks after I helped train our Montevideo Police Department, they saved a 20-year-old young girl with naloxone. She is alive today, now a young mother, because they were there with the right tools. We now have several doctors in our clinic who participate in the ECHO program and are prescribing Suboxone and helping those who are struggling with opioid addiction get into treatment and get their lives back. This is through the St. Gabriel's program from Little Falls. This program would have saved my daughter's life. The issue isn't that we don't have enough dedicated people to run these programs or that we don't have enough patients to be in them. It's that we don't have enough money and enough resources. I have spent weeks trying to find assessors to help people get into treatment. I have searched for detox beds, placements for people who need medically assisted treatment. I've helped set up naloxone training in small communities just like the ones you represent. these would have saved my daughter's life right here in this bill. And 3 years after this, she died, we are still here trying to get help. Since Casey Joe's death, over 1,500 people have died in Minnesota from opioid overdose, and that's not including the other opioid-related deaths, such as heart failure, suicides, accidents, homicides. I'm still amazed that we are asking why this is still the right thing to do. I'm a registered nurse. I work in home care. I'm fairly adept at finding resources, and I could not help my own daughter. I remember my son calling me from California. Casey was there visiting him. He was frightened for her. He was aware that she was in trouble, and he worried about the people she was with. He told her, go ask Mom. She'll help you. But I couldn't. I didn't know how. 6 weeks later, my husband had to call him and tell him that his sister was dead. Now there's enough guilt to go around our family, but none probably more than his. He wanted to save her. He wanted to protect her, and he couldn't do either. You are all in such amazing positions here. You have the chance to be on the side of right. There aren't many opportunities in life where that presents itself. It's uncomfortable, I'm sure, and the pharmaceutical companies are threatening to raise prices so people who need these meds cannot afford them. And as much as that threat should be taken seriously, it amazes me that we actually allow it. There isn't a time that they will come with real solutions, Representative Baker has asked them for. But we have entrusted you all to help the citizens of our cities and our towns across the state. They are ready to do the good work. We just need your help to do it. My daughter, Casey Joe, was also a chronic pain patient. I never would have supported a bill that would have caused her more pain. She deserved to have her pain treated safely, and this bill allows for treatment of pain and provides safety for those who are prescribing these medications. Casey is not to blame for becoming addicted to these medications. Dan was not to blame. Casey was not a junkie. She was not irresponsible. She was not of moral failing. She did not make bad choices. This bill provides solutions that would save lives and promote healing. I can barely live with being one day too late, but please help prevent other families from going through the same agonizing thoughts day after day. I don't want to come back here year after year. Casey Joe would have lived had this bill been around when she needed it, and knowing that others will be saved makes our loss sting a little bit less. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and very sorry for your loss. Cammy LaBelle.
Sorry for my slowness.
Welcome to the committee. Take your time getting settled, and you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Cammy LaBelle. I'm 50 years old. I reside in Lakeville. I'm a disabled rare disease patient that's currently on palliative care because there's no cures for about three of my diseases, and there's no FDA-indicated treatments, and all of them involve horrific pain. Three of them are also known as a suicide disease because of the pain associated with them. Now, looking at me, you may not think that I'm in a lot of pain, but I am. And the reason I am able to be here today is because I responsibly take my medications that are my last resorts. And what I want to do today and say today, in addition to thank you for this opportunity, I really appreciate it. I applaud all of the efforts happening right now in the legislature to address addiction and abuse issues in Minnesota. It is a crisis. There is an epidemic. Per the Minnesota Department of Health data, the majority of the issues are with illegal drugs, illicit fentanyl. And I would be lying if I said it did not involve prescription opioids, because it does. I, however, am a person who have responsibly taken prescription opioids because they are my last resort. There's no cures for my diseases, and I have inoperable spine damage. Some of my concerns on this bill is that I believe that the fees assessed to these manufacturers will actually increase the cost of not only just my medication or anyone who relies on some of this medication to function, to work, to contribute to society, care for their family, bathe themselves, things like that. Things a lot of people take for granted. Without medications, I will be honest, and this is the truth, I cannot bathe myself. My husband has to help me. And without these medications, which currently I am being told that even though I'm on palliative care, I will be force tapered, even though it's exempt in the guidelines for the OPWG work group. Facilities are adopting their own policies that are not even aligned with Minnesota or the CDC guidelines, which are voluntary. The cost associated with my prescriptions, I average $650 to $700 a month. And a lot of that is out of pocket. Some of it gets reimbursed by the insurance company. But even before it gets reimbursed, I have to come up with the money. I have been disabled since 2013 due to a carpal tunnel surgery, which started a disease, a rare incurable disease called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Being as there's no treatment for such, there's no FDA-indicated treatments, and there's no cure, it spread throughout my body. As you probably saw, I have a hard time walking. I do have to utilize a wheelchair at times and use a cane. A lot of times I am bedbound because of the way the diseases work in my system. Now, if I can't afford my medications, my husband is going to have to take care of me all of the time. I may need more nursing services. I responsibly take my medications, and if it gets to a point where I can't afford them, which in the past it has happened where I have gone without and I've ended up in the hospital. So I would just like the legislature and the committee to take into consideration how are these costs going to be passed on to people like me and vulnerable communities who are already disabled, senior citizens, our veterans. I'm lucky I have a husband that still works. And as I said, I'm 50 years old. For half of my life, I've suffered with some type of pain. I used to be a paralegal. I used to contribute to society. I used to volunteer. I used to help my family. I used to be a great mother and a great wife. And these diseases took those opportunities away from me. And the only reason I'm able to sit here today is because of this medication that I responsibly use, and sadly, other people make a decision to abuse or they get addicted. I empathize with anyone who has lost a child due to abuse or addiction. My heart goes out to any parent. I advocate for humane treatment of anybody, whether it's addiction, the disease of addiction, or the disease of pain or rare diseases. Proper humane care is vital for everybody. What I am finding in reading through these bills is that there's so much focus on the addiction, which there needs to be. However, what is happening to the community of people like me and our veterans, the people who are disabled, who have last resort medication because there's no cures? I haven't seen anybody standing up for us or speaking up for us. And if somebody is, I would love to talk to them. And because we have something to say as advocates and as being a pain patient and a rare disease patient as at that. And I have tried everything under the sun, and my next resort is actually having to go to Italy because there's nothing in the United States that will help me, and my insurance refuses to pay for the very treatment that can help me. And so I urge the committee to think about us as well and how some of these fees will affect us and our cost. In addition to, there is a group of people, I'm one of them, that rely on this medication to function. It allowed me to be here. It allowed me to put these clothes on. It allowed me to put makeup on. It allowed me to get in the car and ride here with somebody. Just try to keep us in mind with this so we don't get dismissed. There's already patients being abandoned by their doctors. I'm sure people in the medical profession are aware of that. And due to the OPWG statute, did not require anybody from the pain community to sit on the work group, but they did require two people negatively impacted by the opioid crisis, our voices aren't being heard. We want to be part of the solution, but we can't if we keep being blamed as the problem. So I urge you to allow us to be part of the solution. Our insight is valuable. Our experience is valuable. We can help. And we're not being allowed a seat at the table. And so I will leave it at this. I know my time is limited and other people have to talk. We should matter too. And I'm not seeing that we do. And it's unfortunately, it's been very clear in the guidelines. And like I said, in the guidelines, and someone else mentioned earlier, I believe it was you, that palliative care, it should not affect palliative care. I was told that I'm going to be forced tapered from my last resort medication, and I'm on palliative care because I have a malignant disease. It's not cancer. There's other diseases that are malignant that are not cancer. And I have three diseases that are known as a suicide disease, so it's layers and layers and layers of pain. I've had hundreds of injections in my head and in my face because I have cluster headaches too, occipital neuralgia, intercostal neuralgia, trade neuralgia, and I have inoperable spine damage. And these injections that are being forced on us, which I had one 2 days ago that was supposed to help me, that's why I'm shaking right now, because it put me into a flare and it causes more pain. And it interrupts my, I have heart damage from CRPS. And I don't know if anyone in here knows what that is.
And Ms. Lavelle, I appreciate your testimony. I'm glad that you're here. I want you to be sure just to get your final points in so we can let some other people testify. I appreciate you.
My final point is please take us into consideration. We want to be part of the solution. If we're allowed a seat at the table, I believe you will find our insight extremely valuable.
Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Christina Moorhead. Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Christina Moorhead, and I'm a Senior Director of State Policy for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. We represent the country's leading biopharmaceutical research companies that search for new, life-saving, and life-improving treatments and cures. We are facing a public health emergency that has deeply impacted Minnesota and communities across the country. Whether it's a family member, a friend, or a neighbor, we've all seen the heartbreaking grip of addiction. This crisis is too broad and too complex for any one person or group to solve alone. It's been driven by a confluence of factors that must be addressed holistically, with solutions that bring everyone, including manufacturers, prescribers, distributors, government, law enforcement, and non-for-profits to the table. And that's why we're here today and why we've put forth a comprehensive strategy that includes policy reforms that helps those on the front lines. So despite a small presence in the prescription opioid market, only 4% of prescription opioids dispensed to patients are an innovative or brand name drug. PhRMA is committed to doing our part by bringing forth real solutions to help stem the tide of the crisis at a national, a state, and a local level. As innovators, we believe that the biopharmaceutical industry has a responsibility to be part of the solution. PhRMA members have financially supported local programs through the RX Abuse Leadership Initiative, or RALI, to bring Minnesota residents a broad range of solutions to the opioid abuse crisis that have focused on prevention, treatment, and recovery. Working with community-based organizations to determine the areas of greatest need and current best practice programming, PhRMA and its partners provided direct financial assistance through grant funding last year. Additionally, PhRMA and its partners also worked with community-based organizations to donate safe at-home disposal and deactivation pouches. This program resulted in more than 65,000 disposal kits being distributed across Minnesota last year. And in 2019, we plan to continue our ongoing mission to raise awareness of opioid abuse prevention, treatment, recovery, and safe disposal of unused medicines through our community grants and partnerships, disposal kit distribution, and advertising across all platforms. In addition to RALI Minnesota, PhRMA supports a comprehensive policy approach to address the opioid crisis, including the prevention of overprescribing through our support of a 30-day script limit for chronic pain, efforts to educate patients and prescribers, expanding access to appropriate substance abuse treatment, and enhancing law enforcement efforts, all while ensuring appropriate patient access to needed medications. States that have enhanced their prescription drug monitoring programs, including mandatory prescriber use, and have imposed limitations on opioid prescribing for chronic conditions, have seen drastic results in their efforts to stem the tide of opioid abuse. House File 400 does not currently include these types of evidence-based policy solutions to address the opioid epidemic, and we would urge members of this committee to consider these and other policy solutions as you create a comprehensive legislative package for Minnesota. We do have concerns with the unintended consequences that could result from the funding mechanisms included in House File 400. Taxing prescribed medicines intended to treat legitimate medical needs to raise funding will not help in this committee's efforts to address the opioid crisis. Patients receiving hospice care, battling cancer, and with other diagnoses that have a legitimate need for these prescribed medicines to manage their pain. Pharma believes it's bad public policy to fund programs based on taxing of any type of health care service, be it prescription drugs, a physician visit, or a hospital visit. Instead, Pharma proposes that the state use the existing Medicaid rebates the state receives from all drug manufacturers, which would provide more than sufficient funding required for this proposal. In federal fiscal year 2017, approximately $270 million was rebated back to the state from drug manufacturers. Pharma's understanding is that these funds go to the state's general fund and are not allocated for a specific purpose. As House File 400 looks to raise $20 million through fees, the prescription drug rebates the state currently receives from our drug manufacturers would be more than sufficient to fund these programs. Finally, there are a number of legal, operational, and implementation concerns with these proposed taxes, including the legality of taxing Medicare Part D drugs, the potential of reduced federal Medicaid match, potential HIPAA violations, and due process concerns that we raised last year and we continue to have with House File 400 as drafted. In closing, we appreciate and we applaud the commitment of the authors of House File 400 and this committee to addressing this critical issue for communities here in Minnesota. We share in that commitment and we're ready to work with all of you on real solutions that strike the delicate balance of preserving access to treatment for patients with legitimate medical needs while aggressively tackling the drivers of this public health crisis.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up, Dr. Michelle Mayers. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Myers. I'm the Executive Director of Research and Innovation at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I applaud your efforts to address the opioid misuse epidemic, and we want to thank you for including a member of the alternative pain management community in the Opioid Stewardship Advisory Council. Comprehensively addressing the chronic pain experienced by one out of every three Americans requires the skills and resources of the entire healthcare workforce, and that includes complementary and integrative healthcare providers. I'm here today to speak in favor of the provision that would include coverage of acupuncture services for pain in all health plans. This provision ensures that health plans reflect the current best practices outlined in guidelines issued by the CDC, the American College of Physicians, and the Joint Commission. Too many health plan policies lag behind the current research evidence, which supports the use of acupuncture and other non-pharmacologic interventions as first-line interventions for pain. These are often more effective, have fewer side effects, have fewer risks associated with long-term use, and are more cost-effective than standard care, which is now considered to be suboptimal. Optum Healthcare estimates that back pain patients are 75 to 90% less likely to be prescribed an opioid for their course of back pain care if the first provider they see is an acupuncturist or a chiropractor. While acupuncture is a covered benefit in some insurance plans, coverage is inconsistent. For others, it is non-existent. This creates an economic barrier for many Minnesotans to access an evidence-based treatment of their choice. It prevents others from accessing the care that they need altogether. Examples of this include populations for whom narcotics and other prescription medications are contraindicated, including children, the elderly, pregnant women, and addicts. There is a strong economic argument to include acupuncture in all health plans. The preponderance of systematic reviews demonstrate cost-effectiveness or even cost savings with the use of acupuncture for back pain, neck pain, headache, hip and knee osteoarthritis. This is particularly true when analysis takes into account lost work time and the long-term expense of managing chronic pain conditions. In response to legislation in Massachusetts proposing a mandated coverage for acupuncture, the Center for Health Information and Analysis found that full coverage for acupuncture would cost between 38 and 76 cents per beneficiary. Meanwhile, they estimated that it would save between thousands and tens of thousands per beneficiary for a range of pain-related conditions, including migraine, headache, and osteoarthritis. The addition of high-value therapies like acupuncture is a win-win proposition for patients and health plans. I also speak in favor of the provision that compels prescribers to obtain continuing education about non-pharmacological treatments for pain. Physicians and prescribers are essential partners in combating opioid misuse. They must be empowered with current evidence. Provisions like this help to bridge the 14 to 17-year knowledge gap between when research is published and physicians incorporate that evidence into their practices. Most physicians report feeling unsure about when and how to refer to acupuncturists and chiropractors, and often do not feel knowledgeable enough to guide their pain patients through the risks and benefits of alternative treatments. This bill would equip prescribers with the information that they need to responsibly refer and appropriately co-manage pain patients. Tennessee Blue Cross Blue Shield recently delisted opioids from their covered drug list and added acupuncture services. Many other state and commercial health plans are expanding beneficiaries' access to acupuncture in response to the opioid epidemic. Help Minnesota be a leader in healthcare innovation and pass this bill to ensure acupuncture treatment to help all Americans, or I'm sorry, all Minnesotans, not just a select few. Preserve the language that ensures prescribers have the education they need to be good resources to their pain patients. This bill is a step towards ensuring that Minnesota's healthcare system is designed to make the right decision the easy decision as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, Catherine Commit. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Commit, you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm here for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm going to speak to one very specific provision in the bill. It's the language in Article 2, Section 1, which would mandate coverage of acupuncture services. As written, this language would open up this benefit to unlimited services without any consideration for medical necessity or appropriateness. The mandate would apply only to the fully insured market, which is made up of individuals and smaller employers. The fully insured market only represents about 22% of Minnesotans. And when I presented to this committee last week, I used this chart to show you that about 38% of Minnesotans are covered under self-funded plans, self-insured plans, 17% are covered under Medicare, and this mandate would not apply to those two segments of the population. So while I appreciate the previous testifier's comments about trying to get all health plans to do it, passing a law that mandates coverage of acupuncture services does not mean it's going to translate across the entire population. The acupuncture mandate would be in addition to the essential health benefits as required under the Affordable Care Act. Under the ACA, and in an effort to control costs, health care costs, Congress wrote the law to say when states enact new benefit mandates in addition to the essential health benefits sets, then the state is required to defray the additional cost of these benefit mandates. So we have a set of benefits under the essential health benefits. The Affordable Care Act said we don't want states to then go on and add a lot of additional mandates. We just want to start with these essential health benefit mandates. But if a state wants to do that, they can. But then the state would be responsible for defraying the additional costs of that mandate. That would apply in this situation. This mandate would also apply to the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, or CGIP, because even though Minnesota's CGIP program is self-funded, it also tends to follow all of the mandates that are passed at the state level. So there would be an additional cost there. This acupuncture mandate is outside of the EHB and therefore would require the state to defray those costs. Health plans already have coverage for pain management alternatives to opioids, including physical therapy, medication, behavioral health services, chiropractic services, and in many cases, acupuncture services. So it is being covered in certain situations. Acupuncture is often covered for specific indications, and when there are more conservative forms of multidisciplinary therapy, when other more conservative forms of multidisciplinary therapy have been tried and failed to alleviate the pain. In addition, acupuncture is often covered for prevention and treatment of nausea associated with surgery, chemotherapy, or pregnancy. So with that, Madam Chair, happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. And if you can stick around for questions when we're done with testimony. Judy Cook. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates. I'm representing the Association for Accessible Medicines. This is the organization representing the generic and biosimilar drug manufacturers. Brett Michelin, who is their Director of State Government Affairs, was here yesterday for another bill and was not able to stay today. So you have me, but he will be back to talk about this and other important issues affecting generics in the healthcare marketplace in Minnesota. We have appreciated the opportunity to talk with both Representative Olson and Representative Baker about House File 400 and look forward to continuing to be a part of the discussions going forward. Since this is the Commerce Committee, it's not really possible to explain the impact of the stewardship fee in House File 400 without first providing some basic information on the generic drug distribution system, so I hope you will allow me to do that. So generic drugs are more than 80% of the prescription drugs sold, but only 23% of the cost, that's overall. And this holds true for opioids, where closer to 90% of opioids are manufactured by generic companies. And generic companies do not detail to physicians, they do not influence prescribing practices, they don't conduct direct-to-consumer advertising. Since these drugs went off patent, there are often multiple generic companies making the same product. It's also important to note that generic manufacturers have no control over which of their products are sold in Minnesota. So it's a national marketplace, and the generic companies sell to the three largest wholesalers, and then they determine, you know, where the product gets sent. Also, it's important to note that the DEA determines how much any manufacturer can make of any given opioid, and that number has been reduced each year, a 25% reduction in 2017, 20% reduction in 2018, and 10% reduction in 2019. A priority issue for AAM on opioid legislation remains access to appropriate care for those individuals for whom opioids are an important course of treatment. There is excellent work being done to develop and utilize best practices for the prescribing of opioids for those patients for whom these drugs are appropriate and should not be disrupted. AAM supports pill limits, use of prescription drug monitoring program, and other best practices to significantly limit the prescribing and use of opioids as a way to prevent addiction. We also support the evidence-based prevention and treatment programs, such as those contained in the bill. AAM is also working to prevent future addiction by offering a program to educate high schoolers and college-age students about the dangers of opioid and other drug abuse. So our concern with House File 400 is that it does not recognize what has happened since opioids were first brought to the market, when there were brand companies aggressively detailing to prescribers and insurers, urging physicians to treat pain with these opioids. So this licensing fee will fall heavily on and primarily on generic manufacturers. Yet other entities in the supply chain have and continue to be involved in prescribing, managing, and filling of opioid prescriptions. For generic drug manufacturers, the challenge with the structure of the stewardship fee of $12 million for manufacturers is that these companies have no control of how much of their product is sold in Minnesota. The wholesalers make that decision based on the amount that is prescribed and dispensed. Manufacturers also have no control over how many other manufacturers are making opioids and what of their product will be sold in Minnesota. And as we've mentioned, the DEA significantly has been reducing the number of manufactured. So when you have a proportional fee, I hope you can appreciate that not having any control increases risk, and that is a concern for our clients. The companies have no way of controlling their proportional number of units, and this is based on a unit sold, and results in an annual increase in their per unit fee. So they don't have any way of knowing what their fee will be. So it's really not as simple as it appears. So generic manufacturers know they are part of the supply chain when patients are prescribed opioids, and recognize that they should have a fair role in addressing the problems that have arisen from the use of opioids, and AAM is willing to participate in a fair plan. Again, generic manufacturers did not create opioids, did not market them, are highly regulated, and only manufacture what the DEA allows. And as you may know, a similar funding mechanism was found unconstitutional in New York. We encourage you to develop a proposal in Minnesota that will be fair and include all parties of the opioid supply chain, and we look forward to working with you on that. And I'm happy to take any questions when the time arises.
Thank you, Ms. Cook, and we'll call you back down for questions. Thank you. One last testifier that has signed up, Michael Dobb. And then that's everybody who has signed up. Michael Dobb? Okay. Looks like he's over here. Thank you. And if you could try to keep your comments brief, we really would appreciate it. I want to be sure that we have time for member questions as well. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair. My name is Michael Daub. My last name is spelled D-A-U-B. I'm on the board of directors of the Steve Remler Hope Network. I'm co-chair of our advocacy committee. We just heard a testifier talk about the lack of responsibility for creating this crisis, that the generics had nothing to do with that. I believe that there's sufficient evidence out in the marketplace that would contest that view. Most of them, if the information available to me, which could be verified through the Board of Pharmacy, if that information is correct, Mallinckrodt is the largest seller of opioid products in the state of Minnesota. Mallinckrodt is an Irish company. It's based in St. Louis. They manufacture, market, and sell drugs in the U.S., primarily generic oxycodone, which is, and they're the one of their largest manufacturers. Just like Purdue developed OxyContin in the mid-1990s, they knew they had to expand their markets and profits. They needed to change the perception of opioids and permit the encourage the use, expanded use of opioids for long-term, wide-spend chronic conditions. So these companies, including Mallinckrodt, began to promote opioids, and in particular, as they promoted them as safe, effective, and appropriate, even for long-term pain conditions. Mallinckrodt misrepresented the risk of addiction for pain patients, claiming that it was modest, manageable, and outweighed by the benefits of opioid use. Mallinckrodt also sells some branded products. There's evidence out in the marketplace that manufacturers like Mallinckrodt, their sales representative visited prescribers in Minneapolis many times in 2013, beginning in 2013, and through as late as 2016. They were frequent visitors to Minneapolis prescribers during that time period. As far back as June 2007, Mallinckrodt gave educational grants to pain-topics.org, a defunct website that proclaimed to be an organization dedicated to offering contents that are evidence-based, unbiased, non-commercial, complying with the highest standards and principles of accrediting and oversight organizations. On that site, they talked about pseudo-addiction as behavior that occurs in pain, patients when pain is untreated. That's one of the claims that crops up in all of the 1,500 lawsuits that are in federal court and the 500 lawsuits that are in state courts throughout the United States. It's one of the things that Big Pharma promoted to create this problem. Mallinckrodt was in the middle of that.
And if you could wrap your testimony up, we need to get to member questions. Thank you.
Mallinckrodt, the generic manufacturer, in July 2017 agreed to pay a $35 million amount to settle allegations brought by the U.S. Department of Justice that it failed to detect and notify the DEA of suspicious orders of controlled substances. In conclusion, any claim that the generics didn't have anything to do with this is simply untrue. I'd be glad to supplement my remarks with additional information for the committee if necessary, as requested. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you for the testimony. And members, I wanted to get to member questions. I've got another note, however, from somebody else who wants to testify. So Todd Hill, and I hope I heard that it was short and sweet, so have a seat.
Yes, very short, very sweet. Madam Chair, and I apologize for the confusion on signing up. Good afternoon, Chair Halverson and members of the House Committee. House Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Todd Hill of Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, or HDA. HDA is the National Trade Association representing 36 primary wholesale distributors. Wholesale distributors are the critical logistics provider of the healthcare supply chain. They deliver medicines and healthcare supplies safely, securely, and efficiently to virtually all healthcare delivery settings nationwide. The products that HDA members deliver range from the most common over-the-counter products to the most complex prescription medications and medical supplies. HDA members do not research, we do not manufacture, we do not market, we do not prescribe medications. HDA members are not healthcare providers or prescribing or dispensing practitioners. We do not influence prescribing patterns, the demand for our products, or patient benefit designs. HDA is committed to working with policymakers to positively influence the opioid epidemic impacting the nation, that's impacting the nation, and recognizes the intent of House Bill 400. Some of the proposals contained in House Bill 400 should be supported. However, we do not support the legislation due to the significant punitive financial assessment it would place on the distribution of legitimate medications prescribed and ordered by licensed medical practitioners and pharmacists. It places a logistics-focused industry in the position of either absorbing a significant financial assessment based on a product that represents a small portion of our overall product volume, potentially denying medical experts and patients the orders that they request, or passing significant costs along to the distributor customers and possibly to patients. This is a no-win situation that could raise healthcare costs or deny medical experts requested orders, decreasing access for treatments and denying activity that's fueled by legitimate patient or prescribers. In addition, the legislation's volume-based policy would result in an environment where, even if prescription opioid demands were to decrease, the substantial license fee would continue to place significant financial responsibility on the healthcare system. In its current form, any volume of opioid product would result in the same aggregate assessment. HDA does not advocate for the use of opioids. Licensed medical professional orders are what determine all of our distributor shipments. There continues to be a place for opioids in the clinical management of pain, and as a result, these products should be accessible to patients when a licensed prescriber determines that they are appropriate and clinically necessary. While this proposal aims to reduce prescription opioid misuse by raising revenue for prevention and treatment programs, specific provisions of this legislation that impose a significant cost burden on the healthcare supply chain should not be supported. Such provisions are an oversimplified and flawed approach that fails to address the root cause of addiction while penalizing all legitimate opioid use. By placing patients and providers at risk of possibly losing access to essential medications, this legislation does more harm than good. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you oppose the license fee provisions in House File 400.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And I know that there are a few people who have continued to sign up since we started. Of course, our time at the Capitol ends up being limited. Our committee time goes until 4 o'clock. We can certainly stay later or recess and reconvene if need be, but I do want to be sure that we get to member questions. So, Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, each member should have the letter I promised I'd deliver yesterday regarding the Minnesota Lottery, so just so you have that. I'd like to thank Representative Olson and Representative Baker for this bill, and I don't think anybody disagrees with what we're trying to do here. I think you can save yourself a lot of heartache if we get the funding mechanism correct, and it's not correct at this point. $20 million tax increase. You know, this isn't a penny a pill. I was doing some math. I figured it's 8 cents a pill, 9 cents a pill. We're adding health mandates in this bill, which affect very few, so it increases the cost because the ERISA plans are excluded. There's really, in the financing part, there's no balance. This is so one-sided. I don't think anybody here did, and I'll just speak for myself. I certainly don't disagree with what we're trying to do here. I want to do what you're trying to do. It's just, I don't think you have a bill that can make it all the way through. And I know this is in the Finance Committee. I'll get to see this in taxes and ways and means. But we have to work on the funding. And I would venture to say that if this bill is so important, which I think it is, why aren't we going just for general fund money? I mean, why have a lopsided, unbalanced way to collect money that is going to create a lot of tension and a lot of pushback as we go forward. So the bill needs work. It needs a lot of work on the financing part, and I think we can do that. This is the, I don't know what, first or second stop in a stop. You're going to be touring the legislature. You've got a lot of committees to go to. I hope we can work on the funding mechanism. But just a couple quick questions. The fees, I was reading through this, the fees are based on number of units of manufacturer reports to the board. What is a unit? And I don't know if Ms. Pompeo or the authors, what is a unit?
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, is Cody Weiberg here for the Board of Pharmacy? He would be the right person to answer that. Otherwise, Dave can take a crack at it too, but I'd prefer to have him give his expert opinion if he is here.
I don't see Dr. Weiberg. So, Representative Baker.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, this question was asked in the last committee, too. So, great one. A dosage is a pill, or it could be a patch, or it could be something in liquid form, but it's one dosage. So, but it comes in different forms. But 95% of what we're thinking about is a pill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Baker. You have such, you know, the fee is based on a unit. You could have a unit that costs 2 cents or a unit that costs $2,000. So I think we really need to look at doing some work there. And again, I am all behind what you're trying to do. We've just got to fix the payment. I think this will go a lot quicker and a lot better. And it's not a finance committee, so I'm not going to talk about money all that much. So, Representative Olson, the first thing you said was we want to end this crisis. And we do. We certainly do. So then it begs the question, reading through the bill, if the opioid epidemic ends or greatly diminishes, is there the ability for the fees to decrease? Because if your plan works, which I hope it does, and we eliminate or greatly reduce the problem, are we still going to be charging $20 million for something that's been taken care of?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Davids. A part of the bill is also our advisory council. And if you notice in the bill language, too, around the work of the advisory council, they will be making recommendations with what is happening in the stewardship account where these fees will be going. And part of it, they talk about making a recommendation moving forward. I think there's a date language in there around 2023. So there will be further discussion. We put it in the hands of stakeholders to have this discussion. But I'd also say that this has come at significant cost already to our state. You know, we'll hear about it and have heard about it. And addiction doesn't end with the opioid crisis. That this is a big thing we're trying to tackle. Like I mentioned, we're talking $20 million in revenue here. My county alone in out-of-home child placement costs is digging out of a $26 million hole. So this is a big bite of the apple, and I love how optimistic you are that we're going to get to a point where this is not going to have a cost to our state in the near future. But I do believe we put into, that's why we have a great advisory council with lots of stakeholders to continue to look at that stewardship account and how we use that wisely.
Representative Davis.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, I was just using your words when you said that we would end this crisis, and I hope we do. This bill, I can't vote for this bill at this point. I can certainly support what you're trying to do in the end game. I'm all for that. But to have a heavy-handed, one-sided, non-balanced way to pay for this is just not right. And I think that where it should come from, and I think you would get a lot of support, again, I can only speak for myself, this needs to come out of the general fund. And again, we're not talking about money. I apologize, Madam Chair. This is an increase in the sick tax, mandates, higher taxes. Take out the general fund. This bill is so important that I cannot believe that any member would not support taking this money out of the general fund. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Baker, for your efforts.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just backing that up, Representative Davids, I was outside in the hallway chatting with some folks, so I don't know if I'm going to rehash a couple things or not, but just kind of that conversation of the acupuncture and kind of the addition to that as a treatment, was that in last year's bill as it moved forward?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives Swazinski. So pieces of this were, there was a bill that passed the Senate floor, and I would also say that a lot of this fee language, not that we need to talk about what happened in the Senate side, but there has been quite a bit of vetting on that regard and had good bipartisan support. And Representative Baker could probably speak to some of the provisions he carried. But at some point in time, this conversation did become a part of, if we're going to go upstream and not just, we need to talk about how we use non-pharmaceutical options for pain management. So this has been a part of the conversation, and Representative Baker could probably speak to that too.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, it was part of our bill last year, House File 1440. We looked at all kinds of other options that were not opioid related to try to bring that awareness as well.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just kind of a follow-up to that, just for the group and ourselves, we're focusing in on the 22% of individual, self-pay insured. Why are we, from an acupuncture standpoint, maybe not allowing that or asking that for the rest of plans and that sort of thing?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. Sorry. Representative Baker.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Committee, I would say that if we've got other ideas, love to have them. We are got many stops to go. Mm-hmm. This is not a perfect bill. What we are trying to do is to make sure that we have more options on the table than what's there now. 22% is better than zero, and so we think having a part of this is better than nothing. So if members have better ideas, we still, again, have more stops to make. We have wide open ears. We'd love to hear from you and love to hear your better idea.
Madam Chair, I too just want to congratulate you two both on doing good work in this. I believe there is something that needs to happen here. I share other members' concerns of where that funding does come from. If one thing we've heard doing town halls across our districts is help with cost of health care, talking about mental health, but also the opioid epidemic that all of our small rural communities are enduring. And, when you look at the realities of, a tax incidence study, when you raise taxes on a business, a small or big one, 95% of those increases in costs or tax or fees or whatever you want to call it get passed on to the consumer. And, we know that this is a big cost when it comes to our communities. We know that it's costing hospitals. It's most importantly costing families grief of suffering of losing a member. But we need to look at these goals from a holistic standpoint and which direction are we going. And, I think if we could fix where this funding mechanism comes from, I think we can have 100% support on the House floor. But I just ask that you work with members that do have concerns about maybe going the wrong direction from a finance standpoint, and look at the general fund, and I think we can go a lot of places with this bill and make a difference in people's families.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. And because our time is short, members, and we will certainly make sure that every member gets to have their questions answered thoroughly, so we will take the time we need. But I do want to remind members what the purview of this committee is and that it does have other staffs in finance committees. So, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, I don't know where I am on the list. Is Representative O'Driscoll ahead or behind me? Obviously, he's probably behind me.
Representative Kreisha, I can guarantee you I did not skip over the GOP lead on the list.
Okay, well, he had asked if he could just get a quick one in before mine, which would be fine with, I want to defer to you as the chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill authors for being here today. Madam Chair, this is very timely, and my apologies because I came into the committee late, but you talked about the purview of the committee. Have we defined what is the purview of this bill for the Commerce Committee? I've heard members sharing different things about, well, this isn't a finance committee, this is this. Do we know what we should be discussing as it relates to the text of this bill? And if so, could we maybe just keep the conversation for that, to that realm?
Well, I think, Representative O'Driscoll, as I indicated, this is not technically a finance committee. However, being this is the Commerce Committee, the great vast majority of this bill falls under our purview. And so, but I do think that if the focus of the discussion is going to be on the financing portion and where the money is coming from and should it come from the general fund, that that is much more suited for a finance committee. So. The point has been made a couple of times, so if that's where the conversation needs to be, it might be better to have in a finance committee and focus on other parts of the bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just, again, helping to define the time that we have and the mission we have to accomplish, and so it's just helpful, I think, sometimes for members to know going in what the purview is so that questions can be specified for that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Olson. Thank you, Representative Baker. And I mean that sincerely. I know how hard you're working to actually get as much support as you can. And this is, there's a lot here. I have some specific, there's a lot of great stuff here. I have some specific questions, and I'll be very upfront. I mean, the Little Falls program, you heard from Officer Strack, the Little Falls folks have championed this, and we've seen them many, many, many times. In fact, they are, in my opinion, the earliest seeders of some of the solutions. And it because of that, it brings me to some questions. So these are all just questions that I'm trying to make sure I get clarification as well as possibly improve the bill. But you have, in this bill, you have an advisory council as well as a, and this is a question for Representative Olson or Representative Baker, but you have an advisory council as well as DHS. Who will actually administer the funds?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the Advisory Council makes a recommendation based on the criteria we lay out in the bill.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And so I want to make sure, because that seems 4.7 through 4.15 contradicts with 17.11 if I read it, because it looks like DHS has the ability to put a grant program together and administer those funds, but then the Advisory Council has the ability to make recommendations. My concern is, are there going to be conflicts, and is that going to hold the process up?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kreisha. The intention is not to hold the process up, and if there is a problem, we should certainly work that out. And I think to your larger question is, you know that there's effective programs in our state that do well. You have one in mm-hmm. your district. I do. Others do. We heard great testimony when we were in Mille Lacs about how tribal governments are leading and how we have so many unique needs and so many different ways to meet them. So I think the intention here is to be able to allow for as many places to be able to apply for these different funds and have the advisory of the council and have their advice with these criteria we lay out.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you. And I think that I'm glad you stated your intention. I think we need to clean this up. Here's my fear. Take it for what you want. But the way this is set up and the way I've seen other programs set up, you will have two competing interests. You will have an advisory council, and it's going to be very political. I look at the way that, and I understand why. I'm not despairing that at all, but it will just be political on who gets appointed. Some get appointed, some can be named by the commissioner. So you're going to have a very political advisory council, and then you're also going to have DHS that's going to have the ability to make recommendations. And inherently, the way this is written, I can see conflict, And let me give you a scenario that I hope would never happen. And again, I'll go back to Little Falls. My Little Falls program needs about $2.5 million. They have taken more pills off the street than any other program. The way this is set up, the advisory council doesn't even meet until October 1st of 2020, and therefore they may not even be ready to start making recommendations to DHS. We could see a scenario where money doesn't even hit the streets of our programs for 9 to 10 to 12 months out. Now, that certainly, I'm sure that's nobody's intent, but I'm telling you the way this is written now, that exists. We all know at the speed of which bureaucracy moves. And my biggest fear on this, I will tell you right now, is I have a program sitting in Little Falls that has, they're training well over, and Officer Strack, you might be able to, is it 100 communities? We're training over 100 communities for the ECHO program, and they're out of money. And if they have to wait 12 months before we figure this political process out, that's 12 months where we're not taking pills off the street. I'm not despairing your bill. I am despairing the way the language is written. I want this fixed because I think the last thing we want to do is come back next January and say, okay, how are we going to fix this?
Representative Crescia, before I go to Ms. Representative Olson, are you saying that there's no work going to be done? Is that it before this advisory council is in place? And if so, can the author address that?
If I could, Madam Chair, I want to address that because, again, Representative Crescia is helping us make this bill better. What he doesn't understand is this isn't the holistic bill of all the work that we're going to do in opioids. We aren't going to see a dollar if this passes tomorrow for at least a year, year and a half. We are going to need more general fund dollars this year, which is going to satisfy Representative Davids. So we are going to likely have a separate bill because what this is, as I mentioned earlier, this is a kicker bill. This is one to help us sustain longer term to do some more medically assisted stuff that we need to do. This is not the whole package, folks. This is not everything we're going to do about opioids, and this is not the golden parachute. What this is a stepping stone of having some new revenue ideas, and I think I want to correct one thing that maybe Representative Olson didn't quite understand my intent of the bill before, and I think it's the same. We, this advisory committee, laser-focused as it's going to be, is going to make this recommendation to the DHS commissioner. What we don't want is multiple grant programs competing for each other. We need one conduit. What we don't assure is that the commissioner is going to do what we recommend that he does, or he or she does, but that person will also have a seat at the table. So the department will be there at the table with us the whole way. So our intent here, and if we've got this language not perfect, let's make sure we have a funnel system going through the commissioner of DHS that will allow us to use those funds in that way. So if we've missed, well, let's correct that as we go forward. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just echo what Representative Baker said, that there are a set of bills that are going to move forward. And I believe there's actually one that is either in draft or happening or been dropped that actually gets at exactly your program, and maybe you'll want to co-author that. So that we do need general fund because I think there was also a comment made, you know, that this is going to be a ways out, and so this isn't it. And if anybody wants to work on a general fund or, you know, other things, there are other paths forward in that. And just to also go back to, the goal is definitely to Representative Baker's point about the council is making the recommendations, and we are putting criteria there to be able to have the most folks impacted by this be able to have their programs in all areas of the state and whatnot, too.
And I know you've got a follow-up, Representative Crescia, just for your edification, it's going to GovOps next, so the oversight of the and governance will be addressed more very thoroughly in that committee because that's the purview of that committee.
Yep.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, and thank you for that, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Baker. So you just brought up a very interesting point, and that is what you're telling us is we're going to put some other money out there. We're going to get some of this stuff taken care of right away, but we haven't done that yet. But instead, what we've done is we've taken the longer approach, the harder approach, and harder in the chance that there's a lot here. We're moving that forward first, when the reality is we need the money. We need it appropriated from general funds. We have working programs. The best thing we could have done right now, and if you want to catch somebody, you catch Officer Strack behind me, is we could have gotten their funding to them in January. They run out of money, and other programs too. And to your question, Madam Chair, if we don't get that money to them, yeah, these efforts stop. In my area, the hospital's not funding this because they have other things. And so I'm telling you the single most effective program that's going on in the state right now and training most programs is running out of money, and if we're going to be working on how we can do this with the advisory council, we're slowing this process way down.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, just a quick question for the author, and then I had one other question. I know it was raised by one of the testifiers, the New York piece of legislation that was struck down in the courts. And I'm just wondering if Representative Olson could just comment on, I know there are differences between our Minnesota law, and I wonder if you could comment on some of the or at least the key differences with the New York law.
Representative Olson, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. We don't have what the New York law had in there. So that's the long and short of it, that it's not in here, that we don't have the pieces that were struck down in the courts in New York. So that is not in here, just to be very, very clear. To move forward and think we may not have a court challenge, though, we're not writing a bill with the hopes of that, and that's not, but I would imagine there may be a scenario where that could happen around some other piece, but just to be clear, that part is not in the bill.
Thank you. And then
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just I had a question, and I'm not sure who's here the right person to answer it, really, but just to kind of get at this notion of the unintended consequences and this response that if this fee is placed on our drug manufacturers, that prices are going to go up. And just looking at some of the price increases this year, keep in mind there hasn't been a stewardship fee, the drug OxyContin this year is up 9.5%. And that mirrors thousands of drugs that have had double-digit price increases year over year over year. You just look what's happened with insulin prices that have tripled in the last 10 years, doubled in the last 4 years. And a few words by either testifiers or members defending this I've heard is, or comments on the stewardship fee, that it's punitive, that there's no balance, that it's heavy-handed, that it's one-sided. Well, I would say what is punitive is what happened with a drug like Actar, a drug that Mallinckrodt owns that went from $40 a dose to about $40,000 a dose. That is punitive, I would say. And so I guess my question for anyone here representing Big Pharma is, in what instance are you not going to be here raising prices of our drugs? And I say that a little tongue-in-cheek. But I suspect what the answer might be is that, oh, it's not exactly us. This is very complex. That was referenced today. But you just look at the revenue of some of these large companies. McKesson, $208 billion in revenue last year. And just the fourth quarter alone, AmerisourceBergen, $43 billion in the fourth quarter, a 10% increase. Cardinal Health, $35 billion increase in the fourth quarter, a 7% increase. And just to put a finer point on this argument we're hearing from these drug companies, they created these powerful drugs. They were dishonest about their danger to the public, then raised the price over and over and over again, made billions and billions of dollars. And now that they're asked to contribute a sliver, even a sliver of a sliver, they have the gall to say, well, you know, we can't do that because we're forced to raise the price. And you can't do that because right now people are forced to choose between buying their groceries or taking their prescription drugs. I mean, it's laughable. It would be laughable if it wasn't so infuriating. And so, I mean, my only other question is just, have you no shame? I mean, sorry, Madam Chair, and I know.
Okay, I just want to remind people that we don't do audience reactions in committee, so thank you.
And so, and quite honestly, my question, it gets back to what Representative Baker said at the beginning about genuinely coming to the table. I mean, there's been a lot of platitudes about wanting to be part of the solution, but being part of the solution is contributing to the solution, and that would be my ask to those companies, is to get beyond the platitudes and to actually have a stake in solving a crisis that you helped create. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howard. And for members, I know our packets are quite full, but there is a handout in your packet that shows aggregate opioid market by brand and generic. And this is pretty telling in terms of the amount of dollars that is flowing from patients, from payers to drug companies, and we're looking between $200 and $250 billion. And so I think your point, Representative Howard, about where the shared cost is a good one when you look at the cost to our governments, the cost to our families, the cost to our communities. So I appreciate you bringing that up and invite and really encourage people to take a look at that. Next on the list, Representative Carlson. And members, we are at our end time. We will go until 4:15. So if we can keep things as brief as possible, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief. I'm a proud supporter of this bipartisan bill, and I think one of the main reasons why it is so bipartisan is because we have come to realize that the businesses, the pharmaceutical companies, and the distributors have benefited massively from an epidemic which they were at the heart of, and need to now come and be responsible for the actions that they have taken in creating this crisis. A lot of the arguments that we've heard so far today completely disregard the massive public cost that has been placed in our communities. And it's time that where the taxpayers have been burdened with paying for this, that the pharmaceutical companies and distributors basically pony up for a problem and a crisis that they created. I'll stop at that due to a short time, but thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question I'm not so sure for who, and I'm not so sure it can be answered today. But as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, you know, we hear a lot about the opioids that make it on the street. And I'm curious how those opioids make it on the street. And, you know, I come up from a profession where I can buy a kitchen cabinet, and the wood and the whole construction has been tracked all the way to where that tree was cut down. And I guess my question to the industry and to other folks is there a tracking system to make sure that all these drugs, all these pills that are getting produced are actually making it into the pharmacy and are actually making it into the hands of patients who need it? Because I'm a little bit concerned that the tracking methodology for this industry may not be what we want it to be, and I know it's not part of this bill, but I wanted to bring it up here today as something for us all to think a little bit about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean, and I know it's outside the purview of this bill, so I don't know if either one of you want to respond. Representative Baker.
Again, Madam Chair and members, this has been a question that's asked before. I've asked the question to Dr. Weiberg, the director of the Board of Pharmacy. There's a system called the ARCOS system out there that tracks all the drugs and pharmaceutical pills and dosages and things that move around the country. In a very high level, that is how the board manages and tracks all the volumes of pills, where they came from, what company brought them to us, where they're delivered to. I have no plan of trying to give you any more detail than that, but Dr. Weiberg has that. There's a system in place, and they already have a system that tracks all that. That's how we also know the volumes of these and how these companies would pay their fair share.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representatives Olson and Baker. I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward again, and you know I support it. I absolutely think it's the right thing to do. You've got good things in this bill. But my concern is, you know, we're holding the manufacturers accountable, but my concern is about prescribers. 10 years ago or so, my son separated his shoulder snowboarding, and part of his treatment recovery was opioids. And I'm very fortunate that he was going to school and didn't like the way it made him feel, and he needed to drive. So he didn't take very many. But when he went in for his follow-up visit, the doctor walked in, and the first thing he said was, "Do you need more painkillers?" That is a huge problem to me. My son was really upset about this visit because he's like, "Mom," he walked in, said, "Do you need more drugs?" Didn't even check my shoulder, didn't even touch me to see if everything was healing okay. Just wanted to know if I wanted more drugs. As a parent, I'm like, holy smokes. Wow, that just blew my mind, and I was horrified. So is there anything in the bill that addresses something like that? Are we holding folks accountable for the amount that we're prescribing?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair Halverson, and thank you for your a really good question, Representative Tice. We did. We put something in, and I think we can continue to strengthen that. And like we've been saying this whole time, that maybe this isn't going to be the everything we do, but I think that is definitely part of the conversation, and we do have parts of that in this bill as well. So it's the Article 3, Section 6 here, starts to get into some of that around that piece of it. So we do have that in here. So I'm glad to hear that that's something you support. And, you know, we're going to continue to make that better and think about that. So to that point, when conversation comes up about people coming to the tables, what is the provider responsibility, the prescribers, the pharmacists, we do put that in this bill. And that's the way they can be a part of the solution, is to make sure that they're good stewards of what they're doing and the care they're giving. And that is definitely a part of the bill. And I think that goes back to why then we're asking other actors to come to the table if we're requiring changes of certain professions like providers and prescribers, that then we need other people to also change their practices too.
Representative Tice, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Olson. I just want to make sure that we hear that, because we're hearing so much about the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we hear something like that. Mm-hmm. I also want to say that I do really support the acupuncture part of this. I use acupuncture all the time for back pain, and I think we've got a lot of ways that we can treat pain, and I hope that Ms. Commit and I can have a conversation sometime, because I know it is a concern with the insurance companies, but I pay for it because it is very valuable to me. There are some times when I can't breathe or walk without feeling like there's a knife going, it's really hard, but I believe in those opportunities, so I'm really glad that you're doing that. I am concerned that we're not seeing, we're taking out a lot of the education piece for children, and I'm hoping, as Representative Krisha had said, you know, he's concerned about the education part as well. Are we going to see that in another bill?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair Halverson. And another great question, Representative. Yes, so this was a bill that moved as a standalone before, and there has been such an ask for education components of this, but this is going to be traveling as its own bill. And there is a lot of great advocates and legislators willing to work on that. And if you have an interest in that, I'm sure there's room at the table for that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. As Representative Baker knows, I have a friend and a constituent who lost his son. And on his behalf as well, because we've had conversations about this bill, thank you, because the pain never goes away.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, Representative Baker, for your collaboration and your hard work to address an issue that I see every single day I go to work as a prosecutor for Hennepin County. The word crisis is getting thrown around a lot today, but there's no aspect of what's going on in Minnesota that's more true. Mm-hmm. And you see it when you look into the eyes of someone who is really struggling with opioid addiction, as I do every single day that I go to work in Hennepin County. And I'll tell you, I'm really frustrated by the conversation here about this bill creating cost for Minnesotans. This bill doesn't create cost. This bill holds accountable the people who are creating the cost and makes sure that the costs are being paid for appropriately by the people who created the problem. Because the fact of the matter is, Minnesotans are already paying day in and day out for the effects of the opioid crisis. And members, I would encourage each and every one of you to go to your local county attorney and ask them about their child protection budget. Ask them about how much more they're spending every single year to deal with the consequences of the opioid epidemic. I can tell you that hardly a month goes by that I don't open my email and see an email from Mike Freeman, the Hennepin County attorney, or Dave Brown, his chief deputy, announcing new hires into our child protection department of case managers, announcing that senior attorneys from our criminal prosecution division, people who spend their days trying to keep us safe from murderers and violent criminals, are being transferred over to child protection, because the volume of cases that we are dealing with as a result of this crisis is just overwhelming. And that costs money, and that money is being paid by Minnesotans right now. And I want to put a fine point about what that experience can be like on a day-to-day basis as a prosecutor, because you know, I am haunted by the amount of times that I have looked in the eyes of a pregnant woman who's in custody in Hennepin County, and you realize that the person needs to stay in custody because if they go out, they will use, and that child will be born addicted to heroin. I had a case not too long ago of a woman who was having her fifth child, and the last three had been taken by child protection at birth because they were all addicted to opioids at birth. I shared that story with someone who works at HCMC a short time ago, and that person informed me that it used to be that HCMC would see about a dozen cases a year of children being born addicted to opioids or heroin, and that today it's 6 to 12 a week. A week. The costs to Minnesotans in dollars and tears are absolutely real. They're there already. This bill doesn't create them. This bill is about accountability. And that's why I'm proud to vote for it.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank both of you. And I'll tell you an opening orientation when you brought this forward. And this disease, this situation has ripped through our communities. It has destroyed lives. It has destroyed families. And for us not to take this, and I was so upset to hear that it passed the House 62-5, or the Senate 62-5, and it didn't even have an opportunity in the House. But ladies and gentlemen, that's going to change. That's going to change because we're going to hear this, and it is going to pass, and we are going to impact and help the lives of people in our communities. No one should have to suffer the way people have suffered, and everybody is accountable. You can't come there, sit at that podium, and say it's somebody else's responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility in this room. I don't care if it's generic. I don't care who it is. We all have to get behind this and see this through. Your words, Representative Stevenson, are all true. It's everybody's responsibility, and by God, I support this wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lislegard. Representative Katuza Watun, my apologies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to piggyback, I guess, on some of Representative Stevenson's words about child protection. All of you may not know that I'm a licensed foster parent in Hennepin County, and just to make sure that you're reviewing the statistics here from this letter from Commissioner Green. 88% increase in children 0 to 5 removed from their homes as a result of parental drug use. We already don't have enough foster parents across the state of Minnesota. This is already an issue. It's a continuing issue. I'm not going to talk a lot about the fiscal impact this is going to have on the state because I think people have put a point on that already. I want to talk about the unintended consequences and the emotional cost to the parents who have lost children, to this epidemic, to the children who have lost parents. Did I say that right? To the parents who've lost children and the children who've lost parents. The children in the foster care system have a disproportionate increase of higher rates of depression, anxiety, behavioral health problems. I don't think that I just want to ground our conversation in that, knowing that this is causing issues for these children going forward. It's going to cause issues in our school system going forward. And these children truly are the future of the state of Minnesota. So when we are talking about everyone coming to the table and truly contributing so that we can stem some of these issues, I just think it's really, really important. And I know Representative Olson, you talked a little bit about the cost to your county specifically. And I want to thank you for including at least 30% of the available funding to Child Protective Services, because I think that it's just so important. And if we can get one child out of foster care, I think that makes a difference. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And Representative Elkins, very quickly, if you
very
can.
Quickly,
thank
I
you.
Into
the mic, sir. We all want to hear.
I know.
Representative Elkins.
I just wanted to build on what Commissioner Representative Stevenson and Representative Katiza Watun were saying about, we have this letter in our package from Marion Green, the chair of the Hennepin County Commission, and if you just go through the cost to Hennepin County taxpayers from the effects of opioids that, that the county government is bearing and paying, and we're paying for through our property taxes, it's easily over $10 million a year. So, you know, just, and that's just in one county in the state.
Thank you, Representative Elkins, and appreciate everybody hanging in there for a little longer today so that we didn't have to come back. I wanted to be sure that we had a thorough discussion about the bill. Representative Olson, Representative Baker, thank you so much for bringing this forward. I do just want to say a thank you to everybody from the public who came, people who testified. This bill is going to be moving on to government operations. You can find that committee hearing time on the House legislative website, and your opportunity to sign up to testify will be there as well, because your voices are really important. Looking around the room and seeing the tears in people's eyes and understanding the impacts that we heard and honestly that we can see from the pain that's in this room, I want to acknowledge that, and I appreciate you being here. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 400 is re-referred to Government Operations as amended.
Yep, as amended.
And that is my motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. You are on your way.